Richard Swinburne is Emeritus Professor of the Philosophy of the Christian Religion at the University of Oxford and a Fellow of the British Academy. For over 50 years, he's been an influential writer and speaker, especially in presenting a philosophical defence of the existence of God. Swinburne believes that the classical arguments for Christian belief can be stated in a manner that is compatible with modern science, and he argues that faith in Christianity is both rational and coherent. Well, critics of religion have recently enjoyed portraying the God of the Old Testament as a moral monster, violent, cruel, difficult to reconcile with a God of perfect love. So I began by asking Professor Swinburne how he responds to those criticisms.
Well, along in many different ways. The first thing to understand about the Old Testament is why we've got it. And the objection that it depicts a vindictive God was one which was well known to Christians before ever they took the Old Testament as a Christian doctrine. And there was a priest called Marcion at the end of the second century in Rome who said, the Old Testament isn't a Christian doctrine at all, a document at all. We should not use it as that purpose. We ought to have just the New Testament, or rather just certain parts of the New Testament. So there was a battle about whether the Old Testament should be included. And in the end, of course, those who wanted it included won. But what is interesting is the reason why, or the conditions under which they got it accepted. And the leader of the party who wanted it accepted was Irenaeus. And he said, we must understand this document not just as a, or always as a historical document, but as having deep metaphorical meaning. And it was with that understanding that the Old Testament was adopted as a Christian document. And what that means is that quite a lot of the parts which seem to suppose God is vindictive in some way have to be understood rather differently, as making a quite different metaphorical claim. The example I always use is Psalm 137, verse 9, where the psalmist pronounces a curse on, or a blessing on those who take the children of people of Babylon and smash their heads against the rock.
Yes, that's it.
Babylon, as I'm sure my hearers know, was where the people of Israel, or the leaders of the people of Israel, were exiled to in the 6th century. And many of the Christian theologians, the fathers, said we can't possibly take this literally because this is not a Christian sentiment. So how are we to understand it? Well, they had a big program of how you understand the Old Testament. For example, talk about Babylon was Babylon was a bad place, and so it was talk about wickedness and the powers of wickedness. The rock stands for Christ. Christ said that he will build his church on a rock, and he who builds on the rock will be saved. So we are to understand this as telling us that the people who take the children of Babylon, and the children of Babylon were meant to be the desires in us which come from wickedness, and smash them against a rock, the rock of Christ, are indeed blessed. So it's nothing to do with the, as they were saying, the fathers who interpreted this were saying, it's nothing to do at all with literal Babylon. It's telling us to smash our bad desires against the rock of Christ, which is, of course, a purely, truly Christian sentiment. And a number of the fathers gave, indeed the most influential ones, gave this interpretation. Now, from our point of view, this sounds crazy. It's not what it meant, that we would say. It's not what the first people who wrote it meant. Well, maybe, maybe not. But what we have to realize is that the meaning of a text changes according to the context in which you put that. That is to say, the Old Testament was formed in a way that first there were little bits, say Psalm, or some of Psalm 137. And then these were put together into larger bits, perhaps a chunk of the Psalms. And then this was put into larger bits still, and then into yet larger bits. When you use a bit, a text that's been written by one person, and you compile a different book which uses that text, you don't mean the same as the person who first wrote it. You mean what it means in the larger context. And so, this verse, and it applies generally, has to be understood in the larger context. And the larger context for the Christian is the whole Bible itself, including the New Testament teaching. So it has to be understood in the light of the New Testament teaching. It may not have been what the first author meant by it, but it's what quite a number of the different authors in the subsequent development of the work meant by it. And therefore, that is what it must, how a Christian must understand that. And it was with that sort of way of understanding Scripture that Scripture became a Christian document.
I can hear the objections to that. People like Richard Dawkins, for instance, would say that's just cherry picking and people simply discarding or explaining away elements of the book that they don't like and just accepting the bits that sound nice to them.
Well, I'm doing history. I don't think Richard Dawkins has ever studied a single book about the history of the Bible. This is undoubted history. Origen, after Irenaeus, was really the person who taught the church to interpret so much of Scripture in a metaphorical way. And two of the most important fathers of the church said exactly the same, not just what they did, but as an explicit doctrine that we have to interpret any text of Scripture in the light of the teaching of the church. And the teaching of the church included paradigmatically the Sermon on the Mount. This was the understanding with which the gospel was accepted. You may remember the phrase in the Nicene Creed, which summarizes Christian doctrine, and it says that God spake by the prophets. Now, this phrase was introduced into the Creed in its final formulation by the Council of Constantinople in 381. And one of the leading fathers at the council was Gregory of Nyssa. And Gregory of Nyssa was a man who interpreted a great deal of Scripture in a highly metaphorical way. He was saying, yes, of course, he accepted God spoke through the prophets, but his understanding of what God meant through the prophets was a highly metaphorical one. And this tradition of interpreting Scripture went on both in the Eastern Church and the Western Church right up to the Reformation. The trouble with the Reformation is that people thought that Christianity could be understood just by taking a Bible and starting at chapter 1 of Genesis, and it would make its meaning clear. But notoriously that won't do, because there are so many passages of Scripture incompatible with each other. You simply can't do that. You have to come with an understanding of which bits you interpret in the light of which other bits. And that is what a church tradition will give you. So I think Dawkins is being far too much in the spirit of the Protestantism in which maybe he was brought up, and a very literal and ill-thinking Protestantism which felt we can understand what the Bible means just by reading it.
So you're calling for a much more sophisticated and nuanced reading of the text, but which bits are to be taken metaphorically and others? Because there's a lot of history there that is written as history.
Sure. Well, I don't have any, the general formula, which was Augustine's formula, well, and the others too, is take everything literally unless you reason not to. And reason not to will be either incompatibility with Christian doctrine, including the New Testament, the teaching of the Sermon on the Mount, or incompatibility with what we know about God through other means, and that included science. Because Augustine was very, in particular, the others as well, but Augustine in particular, was very conscious that the sort of scientific understanding in the Old Testament was rather different from the understanding of the science by the Greeks, inspired by Aristotle, which he, as a highly educated Christian, had been brought up on. The obvious sort of contrast is that the Old Testament, or the earlier parts of the Old Testament, seem to suppose that the earth is flat, whereas the Greeks knew that the earth was round. And there are other contrasts too. So Augustine wrote a book called The Literal Interpretation of Genesis, in which he gives innumerable different possible interpretations of the scientific parts of Genesis. And he doesn't commit himself to any one, or sometimes he does, but not normally to any one of these, but he points out there are many different ways in which you can understand this. Now, what comes from that? Generalizing to our situation, and in their tradition, in the tradition of the people who said that the Old Testament was a Christian doctrine and gave it to us, in their tradition, we must interpret the Bible literally. Unless we know anything of science and history, history is the same, anything of science and history which is incompatible with it, in which case we must interpret it somewhat differently, or if it's incompatible with central items of Christian doctrine, including the moral teaching of the New Testament. And to say this is not a modern reaction, that is what I'm getting at. It was the condition under which the Old Testament became a Christian document.
Yeah, this seems to have been lost in the recent discussions on this issue, you'd agree. What does Jesus think of, well, the Hebrew Scriptures as he knew them, the Old Testament?
I don't think I've got any very general comment on that. He didn't distinguish, as far as I know, but produce for any general thesis of what should be understood metaphorically or non-metaphorically. But he certainly thought that much of it should provide guidance for our life, and that God had revealed himself to the ancient fathers of Israel, and that to them above all nations, and that they had not been obedient to the way of life which he taught them. But he also made it clear that he thought that some of the standards in the Old Testament were interim standards, low standards for a people who couldn't really cope with adequate standards. And he emphasized from time to time that he went beyond the Old Testament, that he was demanding a lot more of people by way of holiness than the Old Testament suggested.
Yes, you've written about the fact that there are different categories of commands given by God to humans. Is that, you think that's a helpful way of people interpreting and making sense of what, let's be honest, can be some difficult material?
You've been reading something of mine. Yes, but if I'm to explain that, I'd better step back two stages. There are moral truths. It's pretty obvious to us at the beginning of the 21st century that sati, throwing a widow on the funeral pyre when her husband died, is wrong. And it's pretty obvious to us that you shouldn't just exterminate races because you don't like them. And it's pretty obvious to us that you ought to keep your promises, at least barring quite exceptional circumstances, and you ought to tell the truth. And you ought to look after your parents and care for your children and so on. These things are obvious. You may say, well, not as obvious as that we are now having an interview. Well, I should think it's rather more obvious than that, because I might be dreaming now, but these things are clear. And we must start building our worldview with things that are fairly obvious. And the truths of some of the truths of morality are fairly obvious. Among these truths are that we have an obligation to our benefactors. Children have duties to their parents, because the parents, and I don't mean just biological parents, but nurturing parents, parents who care for their children. Because in virtue of all that the parents have given the children ought to do something in return. And the obvious way to do something in return is to do what their parents tell them within reasonable limits. If the parents say do the washing up or do the shopping, then the parent ought to do this. It's not just parents too, the state. If the state looks after us in a reasonable way, we have obligations to pay our taxes and do military service and so on and so forth. And what this brings out is that although there are necessary truths of morality independent of whether anyone issues a command, benefactors, within limits at any rate, have the right to issue commands and they impose obligations on us. So parents can do it, the state can do it. Well, God is our benefactor far more extensively and generously than either our parents or the state. Everything we have comes from God, and all the good that parents or the state can do us is due to the benevolence of God. So if God tells us to do something, that imposes an obligation on us which wouldn't otherwise exist. Okay, so that leads to what I have drawn up, that is a suggestion that there are four kinds of moral truths. Just confining ourselves to obligations, four kinds of moral obligations. First, there are obligations which are necessary obligations, quite independent of anybody's command and which no one's command can change. For example, if I've made a just promise to pay a debt to you, I ought to pay a debt to you, and that's that. If I've produce children, I ought to look after them, and not even God can tell me not to do so. But there are also things which I certainly obligations on me, but obligations which God can, if necessary, remit, if he chooses to, remit. Now, why that is the case is as follows. God gives us lots of things, but they are temporary gifts. He gives us life, but of course it's only for 60, 70, 80 or whatever years. He gives us our possessions, and he has therefore the right to take them back when he chooses. But if anyone has the right to take something back from you, they also have the right to allow somebody else to do it on your behalf. I mean, if you owe me some money, I therefore have the right to take it back from you, but I've also the right to ask the debt collector to take it back from you. And therefore, I think there are certain things which God can permit and therefore command someone else to take from us on his behalf. And life is among that, and possessions. So although it's certainly wrong to kill, barring certain exceptional circumstances like war or capital punishment, in general, God could command us to kill somebody for some good reason, and that would impose an obligation on us to do so. I don't say he ever does, but he would, and likewise for their possessions. So there are necessary truths of morality which hold independent of the will of God, and there are ones which hold unless God excuses us from keeping them. But there are also particular commands of God which will impose obligations which wouldn't exist before. He can command us to worship him on Sundays, but for a divine command there wouldn't be any particular obligation to worship on Sundays rather than on Tuesdays or whatever. And also, of course, he can command us to do particular things. He can call a person to be a missionary to a certain place or something. Now, I press fill that out by considering the Ten Commandments. And it's not original to me to do this. The great philosopher Duns Scotus in the 14th century made this kind of distinction, and he said that the first three of the Ten Commandments didn't depend on the will of God. God could not change those. And those are, of course, the commandments to worship God himself and not worship idols. So these would be in the first category. But in the second category, it's implicit in Scotus that the command not to kill or the command not to steal are in these categories. In the third category, something God just imposes because a command which simply wouldn't be an obligation, but his command, there was the command to worship on the Sabbath, which Christians have understood as Sunday. Now, this distinction is, I think, quite useful for dealing with all these sorts of modern issues about abortion and euthanasia and divorce and marriage and homosexuality and you name it. Because the discussion has tended to take place on the basis that if one of these things were wrong, it would be wrong because of something intrinsic to the act and not because God had forbidden it. Whereas I don't think that's so. For example, divorce might be an obvious example. Adultery is breaking a promise that you have made to your spouse, and therefore I think is wrong, quite doesn't need God to command us not to do this, it's wrong intrinsically because that's what it is. Promises ought to be kept. That's a first kind of necessary truth. But divorce can happen by consent. Each party can, each spouse can decide that they don't want the marriage to go on, and they can let each other off the vow. So, but for a divine command, there wouldn't be anything wrong in divorce. But Christians have believed, possibly with one or two qualifications, that God has forbidden divorce. Now, why should he do such a thing? Why should he impose obligation like this on us? Well, because he's got rather a higher standard than the Old Testament, as it were. If people readily get divorced, then that creates an atmosphere in society that, well, if the marriage isn't going very well, it doesn't matter, you can get divorced and marry somebody else. Whereas if there's a climate in society that you ought to try very hard and divorce that you almost always try very hard, then that's going to make marriages go recover when they hit a bad period. Now, marriage is a good thing. It shouldn't be thrown away. But it needs a climate of society to encourage people not to throw it away. And therefore, it requires people who are prepared to stick at their marriage, even if it's not going to make any difference to their marriage, but because it will encourage other people to stick at their marriage to whom it will make a difference. And therefore, God, because he wants us to be useful to him in being good to others, has a reason for commanding us, if our marriages go wrong, not to get divorced, because of the good thereby we will do to other people. So there's a reason for God commanding us to perform obligations, of which this just is one illustration, which we wouldn't have any natural obligation to command, but which is going beyond natural obligation and will do good and make us good people in a more heroic and full way than we would otherwise be. Do. And what goes for divorce goes for extramarital intercourse and various other things of that kind. God issues commands, first for the purpose of coordination, in other words, e.g. to get us worshipping on the same day. Secondly, to get us to do good things which need to be done, but which we wouldn't have any natural obligation to do, and that, in the process thereby, he makes us holier people than we would otherwise be.
I'm speaking with Professor Richard Swinburne. There are some who like to say that God is too big for one religion, and that it's arrogance to claim revelation from God in the way that the Christian religion does. How do you respond to that?
Well, if there's a God, he's going to take an interest in the human race, just as fathers are expected to take an interest in their children. And being a parent's a difficult thing, and you have to take a middle course between giving very clear orders as to what the child should do all the time. On the one hand, obvious bad thing, he needs to work it out for himself. Or on the other hand, providing no guidance at all. Children get lost. And God has the same if I may call it, problem, and therefore might be expected, in view of his perfect goodness, to take a middle way. Middle way of certainly allowing us to work out these things to some extent for ourselves, but also because we are humans, fallible, not very good at it, need guidance, need to be told about what he has done for us, otherwise we wouldn't know.
What are some of those things? You've said a few things we don't work out for ourselves that are actually good for us. What are some of those?
Some of the things that we don't work out that we need to know. Well, to start with, if you're to interact with God, you need to know a bit about him. That helps you to understand who he is and to say the right sort of prayers and to look out for the right sort of things as signs of his evidence, of his existence. And therefore, you need to know that he is a Trinity. He's three persons in one God. God is love, and the love is manifested by there being an eternal unity of three persons in the Godhead. God isn't a solitary being. His very existence involves having within himself three distinct persons in interaction. We are not very likely to find that out for themselves. Secondly, God, I think, makes us, as we know, suffer for there's a lot of evil in the world. God wouldn't make us suffer unless he had some good reason for it. But if a parent makes a child suffer for good reason, there comes a time when the parent has to suffer with the child in order to show there is a good reason. So God has a reason for becoming incarnate and sharing our human life. But if he's done this, he needs to tell us he's done this, because otherwise we wouldn't know. And it's important we should know this in order that we should understand that he is sharing our suffering. So he needs to tell us about the incarnation. If he's issued commands to us, and I've given some reasons why he should, then he needs to tell us what they are. That also must be part of the content of Revelation. If there is to be this continuing, if we're to be aware of these things, not merely when he tells us once, but throughout subsequent history, there needs to be a church who can go on telling us these things. And therefore God needs to tell us that he has founded such a church. So about his nature and what he's done for us and what he commands us to do, we do need a revelation. We wouldn't need it. We wouldn't have the sort of access and interaction with him otherwise. A number of religions make claim to revelation. Not all religions, I may say. In effect, Eastern religions don't make a claim to revelation. Buddhism says you must believe these things not because the Buddha said them, but because they're intrinsically right. But Western religions, in the sense of Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, have made these claims. Judaism's claims are taken over by Christianity, so they're not in conflict. Islam makes somewhat different claims to revelation from Christianity. And we must just use our reason to see which are the right ones. What is special to Christianity is that, as it were, it has a divine signature on the teaching of Jesus and what followed from it. A signature is something that only you can do and other people can't do, and the obvious signature in our own time has been your handwritten name. What God can do and nobody else can do is to set aside the laws of nature. And if the resurrection of Jesus happened in the way that the Gospels say, then undoubtedly it was a setting aside of the laws of nature. And since it was a setting aside of the laws of nature to forward the teaching of Jesus, it was therefore God's signature on that teaching of Jesus. Now, Islam does not have that kind of foundation event, nor does any other of the great religions. So I think there's substantial evidence that the Christian revelation is indeed from God. That's not to say that other revelations might not be partly or to some extent from God, but it is to say the Christian revelation is from God.
And you would say it's this particular activity in the person of Jesus that has this unique aspect of revelation.
Yes.
Yes. I'm speaking with Professor Richard Swinburne. The issue of evil and suffering poses huge problems for those who want to believe in an all-powerful, good God, doesn't it? I mean, there's a there's a depth to that question that people feel incredibly deeply. What's your answer to it, or do you have something approaching an answer?
Yes, I think I do. It's certainly the right reaction if you see suffering to suppose that the being in charge of the universe is not altogether good. That is a good first reaction. But after that, one needs to think about things a little. And let me give you an analogy. Suppose you see somebody sawing off somebody's arm, A sawing off B's arm. Your initial and right reaction was A is a monster. But then you learn that in fact A is a surgeon, and B has got gangrene, and the only way to save B's life is to saw off his arm. When you learn that, then you'll realize that your first judgment is mistaken. And I think the same happens with the case of suffering and the existence of God. When we think about it, there are reasons why God should allow suffering. Now, of course, God can do anything logically possible, that is to say, anything that doesn't involve a contradiction. So God could certainly cure somebody's gangrene without the need to saw off their arms. But there are some things that even God can't do without permitting and sometimes causing suffering. Because God can't do the logically impossible. The logically impossible is that which involves some internal contradiction in supposing it should be done. Just doesn't make sense. Now, it's a good thing for us to have free will, to have a choice between good and evil. And that choice wouldn't be particularly worth having if it didn't make a difference. That's to say, if when we chose to benefit somebody, they actually were benefited, and we chose to harm somebody, they were actually harmed. And it's good for us to have this sort of responsibility for others. The responsibility that the way things go with them is up to us. But we can't have real responsibility if, as it were, the only thing we can do to somebody is provide alternate good things for them. We have to be able to, it has to be up to us whether or not things go well with them. And we're only really responsible if whether for a child, if whether that child is happy and educated depends on us, from which it follows that if we do the wrong thing, he won't be happy and educated. Okay, well, is it a great good for God to give us this responsibility for others? I think it is, but of course it comes at a price, and the price is the others might get hurt. You may say, well, that's clearly good for me who has free will, but rather bad for my children who are the victims of that. Well, 2 points to make there. The first is that, of course, quite often they have their turn of free will, which they can exercise, and other people have exercised their free will on their responsibility for us. But secondly, it is good for us to have the opportunity of forming a holy character. Suffering is therefore, within limits, for a short period, good for us, because if I suffer, that gives me a choice. It gives me a choice of whether to bear this with cheerfulness and non-malice, or whether to bear it with bitterness and self-pity. And only if we have these sort of serious choices can it be up to us the sort of person we become. Because Aristotle made the remark, we become just by doing just acts, courageous by doing courageous acts, and so on. What he meant is, if we do a courageous act one day when it's difficult, and again do it the next day when it's not quite so difficult, and so on, we become naturally courageous people. Humans are made like that. Not all rational creatures need be, but humans are. So each time we bear our suffering with courage and patience without malice, we gradually make ourselves a naturally good person. And it's a very good thing that we should have the opportunity not merely for responsibility for others, but responsibility for ourselves, of the sort of person we are to be. But we can't really have that responsibility unless it's a serious possibility for us that we shall become a different sort of person. And only suffering is going to give us that opportunity. So it's good for us, for a limited period, of course, but then human life is a very limited period. We shall have this opportunity. So I think it's good for us to have responsibility for others, resulting from our free will, and responsibility for ourselves, provoked by the suffering which comes to us. And therefore there is reason, good reason, for God to allow suffering for a limited time, for certain good purposes.
Yeah, it strikes me as a logical, philosophical answer, but when I think of the person standing at the grave of their three-year-old, and I think, what does Christianity have to say to them as a comfort?
Well, the first thing to be said is that people who are grieving and very sad about something need an arm putting around them rather than a philosophical argument.
Sure.
But when, as it were, the worst is over, then of course philosophical argument is in place. And the philosophical argument in place, first and obvious thing to say, is that death is not as such an evil. That is to say, God gives us life. He may give us life for 3 years or for 93 years, but it's a limited life. And if somebody gives you something, they say it's a loan, you can use this for the next 30 years, and then when the 30 years are up, they take it back. The person hasn't wronged you. God hasn't wronged the child by taking it away after 3 years. And the parent should realize this, that the child's life is had the value it did when he was alive, and nobody's been wronged by it being taken away. But of course, Christianity does have another thing to say. Christians believe in life after death, and the Christian message at the graveside to the grieving mother is always, of course, the child has been taken to God, and God will give the child further life.
I'm speaking with Professor Richard Swinburne, just changing tack a little bit here. Intellectual skepticism and anti-religious sentiment appears to be a strong force in the West in recent years. Is this a renaissance of unbelief, or is it the dying gasp?
I believe in free will, and therefore I never predict the future of religion. It's up to us. The sort of arguments we've heard in the last 10 years or so are entirely old arguments. They've been around for centuries, millennia. So there's absolutely nothing new about the arguments. There's quite a bit new about the prominence that's being given to these arguments. One can give a historical explanation, I suppose, of why it's been this prominence. There's been rightly a concern of people about whether religion has presupposes an old-fashioned science and wrong views about history, and we've talked about that. I don't think it does. Then the problem of evil has, of course, rightly again surfaced. Absolutely no new phenomena have occurred, as it were, which haven't been occurring for millennia to raise this problem. But perhaps people in older days had, I mean, an objection to your position is only going to affect you much if you, unless you have doubts about your position anyway. And perhaps people have less conviction about religion these days, and therefore more open to these objections. But I think perhaps there are more sophisticated defences around than there used to be, so these are balanced. And of course, one reason for the decline of materialism has always been the old reason of materialism. When societies are affluent and temptations are rife and the penalties for yielding to temptations are small, it's tough to stand up for hard standards. The important things of life sometimes only come home to you when you're poor and suffering, and that perhaps is a reason, further reason, why it's sometimes good that we should be poor and suffering.
In your private reflective moments, do you ever have your doubts about your faith?
Of course. I mean, it's not just private reflective moments. It's my job to have doubts. I look out for them. And that's right. But I think the balance of evidence is in favour of a traditional sort of Christianity, and that's the way conclusion I always reach after considering the doubts.
So what, one final question, what has Christianity given to you over the course of your life as a believer?
I find it difficult to answer the question just in the way you've put it. God has given me so many things, an ordinary and good standard of living, and a very comfortable job, and an enormously exciting occupation, philosophy, and so on, and allowed me to discover, or at any rate continue to hold, an enormously exciting piece of news that there's a God, and he has concerned himself with humans, and provided a church through which I can grow in him and learn to worship him.
Richard Swinburne, it's been a great pleasure speaking with you. Thanks so much for your time.
Not at all. Thank you.